headlines this hour. China and Russia blast NATO over its position against Moscow and Beijing at the alliance summits in Madrid. NATO says it is ready to help Ukraine obtain a wide range of modern military equipment, urging Russia to withdraw its forces from the country. Plus, Iran's foreign minister says an agreement is possible over the revival of the 2015 deal should the United States adopt a realistic approach. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. China censors NATO over what it calls a completely futile warning, which the Western military alliance declared that Beijing's power poses a strategic challenge.
NATO's so-called strategy concept document disregards the facts, gives a false account of the true facts, wrongly defines China as posing a strategic challenge, and smears China's foreign policy. It opposes China's normal military development and national defense policy, is irresponsible, encourages conflict, and is full of Cold War thinking and ideological prejudice. China is seriously concerned and firmly opposed to this.
Beijing warned NATO against hyping up the, quote, China threat, calling on its leaders to abandon the outdated concept. NATO leaders held a two-day summit in Madrid, where they put China in the crosshairs. They said Beijing's ambitions, policies, and close ties with Russia threatened NATO. Meanwhile, in Moscow, President Putin has said that there would be no problem if Finland and Sweden joined NATO. The Russian president's remarks followed an announcement by NATO that it would welcome such a membership. Putin, however, said that Russia would respond if Finland and Sweden become a ground for the deployments of NATO troops. The president said that it was inevitable that Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm would sour after receiving NATO membership. NATO says it is ready to help Ukraine obtain a wide range of modern military equipment, urging Russia to withdraw its forces from the country. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that Russia's war against Ukraine was, quote, brutal and absolutely unacceptable. He said that Sweden and Finland will sign on Tuesday the NATO accession protocol to formally join the alliance. Comment came 2 days after NATO member Turkey lifted its veto over the accession. The accession protocol must, however, be ratified by all 30 allied parliaments in order to allow both countries to become part of NATO.
Leaders of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization gathered for their annual summit in the Spanish capital, Madrid. As expected, this year's summit turned into an anti-Russia agenda in the wake of growing tensions between Moscow and the West over the Ukraine war that began in February.
President Putin's war against Ukraine has shattered peace in Europe and has created the biggest security crisis in Europe since the Second World War.
The Western military alliance also pledged to ramp up military support for Ukraine.
And today, leaders agreed to strengthen our support by agreeing a comprehensive assistance package for Ukraine. This includes equipment to counter mines and chemical and biological threats and hundreds of portable anti-drone systems.
Western countries, including the United States, have provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of weapons since the war began. Russia sees it as the main factor behind prolonging the conflict.
It seems to us that the kind of line that the West has taken is absolutely counterproductive and harmful. The more they pump weapons into Ukraine, the longer this conflict will last.
Irrespective of huge military support for Ukraine, NATO's ambitious plan for expanding its membership has also driven a wedge between the alliance and Russia. However, NATO leaders have welcomed Finland and Sweden into the alliance after Turkey struck a deal with the Nordic duo to drop its objections.
Today, NATO leaders took the historic decision to invite Finland and Sweden to become members of NATO. The agreement concluded last night by Turkey, Finland and Sweden paved the way for this decision.
Russia says the two countries' accession to NATO is destabilizing.
We consider the expansion of the North Atlantic Alliance to be a purely destabilizing factor in international affairs. It does not add security either to those who are expanding it, those joining it, or to other countries that perceive the alliance as a threat.
The rift between Russia and the West has raised concerns that the ongoing war in Ukraine could escalate into a nuclear conflict, the fallout of which could deal devastating blows to the world.
From the Donetsk, correspondent Johnny Miller talks about how NATO and Western policymakers are pushing Ukraine towards a prolonged war with Russia.
I don't think the NATO has any regard whatsoever about the Ukrainian soldiers dying in this war. They are completely outmatched by the Russian army. I have no doubt, for example, if it was a British army there who was outmatched on the battlefield, NATO would withdraw that army. But they're not doing that for NATO, for Ukraine. They're pushing Ukrainians to continue to fight. And many analysts have said some time ago, increasingly say now, that Ukraine can't win this war. Russia is systematically destroying the Ukrainian army. And more Ukrainians are being called up to fight. So it's civilians who are dying, Ukrainian soldiers particularly are dying. Of course, we don't know the Russian figures, but they are dying as well. And it seems, as you rightly say, that NATO is just pushing for continued war. The most recent statement coming out of America, there's a different statement almost every day, but the most recent statement is that they think that Russia is trying to take over most of Ukraine. And if that's their policy, then that means their policy is to continue the fight, because Russia would be very open to negotiating a peaceful end to this conflict based around giving up some territory in the south and in the east. And for the United States to suggest that Russia wants to take the whole of Ukraine or most of Ukraine, they're essentially saying that we want Ukraine to continue to fight. And of course, NATO doesn't really have the interests of Ukrainian soldiers or the well-being of Ukrainian cities at heart. It's not going to affect their politicians at the ballot box. They can continue to fight Russia in the forlorn hope of damaging Russian power, of trying to damage the Russian army.
Russian forces have pulled out of Ukraine's Snake Island in the Black Sea, citing humanitarian reasons for the move. Russia's defense ministry says the withdrawal was a gesture of goodwill. Moscow says the troops have been done with their tasks in the region. The Kremlin says Russia is not seeking to impede efforts by the UN to open a humanitarian export corridor for Ukraine. In Kyiv, however, the government has a different narrative. It says it was Ukrainian forces who drove the Russian troops out after a massive overnight assault. Kyiv has hailed, quote, foreign countries for their military assistance. Russia captured the strategic outpost on the first day of its offensive in Ukraine in late February. Kyiv and its Western allies say that Moscow is blockading Ukrainian ports to prevent exports of grain. Russia dismisses that accusation. In Afghanistan, several explosions and heavy gunfire have been reported near the venue of the Afghan Jirga, or the assembly of the Ulema, in the capital, Kabul. We were joined earlier by our Kabul-based correspondent, Abdullah Amir Zada, who filled us in on what is known about the incident so far.
Several explosions were heard and heavy gunfire. We do not know about the number of casualties, but Zabihullah Mujahid, the spokesman of the IAEA, has announced that he would have a press conference today in the following hours. Yesterday, actually, there was preparation for this grand meeting. The roads were closed, and the number of security soldiers and the protocols were increased very much. But today this happened, these explosions and barrage of fire. We do not actually know many things about that yet, because Taliban officials have not announced any details on this.
The Iranian foreign minister says an agreement is possible over the revival of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, if the U.S. takes a realistic approach. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says that Iran is resolved to reach a good, strong, and lasting agreement. He made the remarks in a phone call with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani. Amir Abdullahian said that Iran has always taken part in the JCPOA revival negotiations with initiatives aimed at reaching an acceptable agreement. Al Thani, whose country hosted indirect talks between Iran and the U.S. over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions earlier this week, described the talks as constructive and positive. You see, the Qatar is ready to host further talks until a desirable agreement is reached and all parties return to their commitments under the 2015 deal. The accord was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally quit it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. onto Syria, where an Iranian firm has rehabilitated part of the Aleppo power plant, a step towards reviving Syria's industrial hub, whose electricity grid was destroyed during the years-long conflict. Iran's Mapna Group has repaired the fifth unit of the plant, bringing over 200 megawatts back to Aleppo's power grid. The first unit will also be ready for operation soon. The station, which has five units, produced over 1.1 thousand megawatts before the Syria conflict. It is one of the biggest plants in the country. The Iranian firm started the project in 2017 after Iran and Syria signed a memorandum of understanding to restore electrical infrastructure in the Arab country. The plant was reportedly hit by the U.S. warplanes a few years ago and went out of service. Israeli lawmakers voted on the dissolution of the Knesset, a development that marks the end of Naftali Bennett's tenure as prime minister. The dispersal of parliament will fuel continued political instability in Israel, pushing the regime towards its fifth election in just over 3 years. The lawmakers have also voted to hold the elections on November the 1st. Last week, Bennett moved to dissolve the Knesset after his ruling coalition collapsed following a series of defections. The prime minister says that he will not run in the upcoming elections. His predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, has called Bennett's administration the worst in Israel's history. Netanyahu is planning a comeback by winning a sixth term in office, even though he's on trial for a number of corruption charges. For years now, the Israeli regime has kept the Gaza Strip under siege. The blockade has made life extremely difficult for local residents. The regime fully controls entry into and exit from the coastal sliver via land, air, and sea. Palestinian activist and journalist Wafa Aludeini believes that the siege goes way back, much earlier than the year 2007.
In 1967, when the Israeli occupation, when they occupied the Gaza Strip, they imposed a blockade, and they control every single thing here in the Gaza Strip. They just destroy Gaza port. They just, close Gaza port. And during the Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, they also destroy the airplane here. Airplane here in Gaza in 2005, I guess. So they control every single thing here in Gaza. And when we talk about siege, it didn't start in 2007. It just started in 1967. And actually, this blockade got tightened in 2007 by the occupation after the Palestinian and the legislative election here in Palestine. They just imposed or tightened the Israeli siege in Gaza.
Britain has accused Russia of using food as a weapon of war. Yet London itself has often resorted to blockades in an apparent attempt to push its colonial ambitions. After all, starvation has been a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
Aside from the UK using food as a weapon of war, there are other violations that Britain has done. Sanctions, for instance. The UK has used blockades on a host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few. When Iran was occupied by the British and Soviet forces in World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over 1 million Irish people died of starvation. 1.5 million more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces. Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, ukraine.org/en.
The Limelight.
Since the financial crisis of 2008 and subsequent quantitative easing by printing billions of dollars to keep the U.S. economy afloat, the economic might and stability of the American monetary system is not what it used to be in the minds of many nations. Here we present you an article in this regard written by George Koo under the heading, Biden's Policy Toward China is a Road to Self-Destruction. The article was published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. President Joe Biden's administration appears determined to project the image that the U.S. remains the world's hegemon regardless of cost or consequences, and despite overwhelming developments around the globe that are contrary to such misguided hubris. The American leadership has always rested on the carrot and stick approach to rally countries around a unipolar world headed by the U.S. The carrot is in the form of foreign aid Uncle Sam dangles before a country as reward for joining the American camp. The stick is the threat of economic disengagement and sanctions and the withholding of military protection, thus stripping away that nation's sense of security. Since the financial crisis of 2008 and subsequent quantitative easing by printing billions of dollars to keep the U.S. economy afloat, the economic might and stability of the American monetary system is not what it used to be in the minds of many nations. When the Biden White House unilaterally confiscates foreign reserves owned by other countries but held in the U.S., such as in the cases of Afghanistan and Russia, the reputation of the U.S. as a fiduciary is in doubt. The full faith in and credit of the U.S. regime ceased to mean very much to the world. Thus, the carrot has dried and withered, and after the 20-year war and debacle in Afghanistan, the stick Uncle Sam carries appears to have shriveled and is not so intimidating. Sending arms but no troops to Ukraine merely confirms America's preference for war by proxy with little appetite for direct engagement. Yet the Biden administration seems oblivious to the erosion of the U.S. stature as the world leader, but insists on going around the world, approaching each country, and demanding that it choose sides and align with the American geopolitical positions. The U.S. has elected to designate China as its adversary for the foreseeable future. For allies and would-be allies to side with the U.S. means they must also regard China as their adversary as well. The American demand places these countries in a dilemma because regarding China as an adversary is in conflict with their own national interest. China is most likely their most important trading partner and a potential major investor and major supporter in the building infrastructure under the Belt and Road Initiative. China has expressed no interest in displacing the U.S. to become the world hegemon and places no demand or expectation that countries choose sides. Friendship with China does not discourage or preclude friendship with the U.S. or any other government. Beijing's style of international diplomacy makes it easy for countries to get along with China and with the U.S., while demurring from being a fully committed formal member of the American alliance. The summit of the Americas held in Los Angeles this month, hosted by President Biden, is just the latest indication. Many Latin American countries, including Mexico, found reasons not to attend. Nothing like throwing a party that used to be a must-show event that nations now decide to bypass. The Russian State Duma Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin suggested recently that the G7 nations, once considered the world's leading economies, are continuing to crack under the weight of sanctions imposed against Russia, obviously referring to the sacrifice of their economies and economic self-interest in order to meet the demands of the U.S. Most other nations will have nothing to do with the American-imposed sanctions against Russia. From the non-compliant group of nations, Volodin proposes the formation of a new group of eight as counterweight to the G7. He selects Russia, China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, Iran, and Turkey as members of the NG8. Volodin reasons that this group of eight countries with a combined GDP measured in purchasing power parity, PPP, is 24.4% larger than that of the G7 nations. Furthermore, the NG8 contains about half of the world's population and is much more representative of world opinion and interest. Ironically, Russia left the G7 group in 2014 and is now the promoter of NG8. This development can only be attributed to American insistence on remaining on top of a unipolar world, a unipolar world vaporizing Star Trek style as we speak. The Biden White House seems to think it has succeeded in getting Ukraine to go into war with Russia and is willing to send another $40 billion worth of weapons to Kiev to enable it to fight to the last Ukrainian. They now think that they can persuade Taiwan to do the same, namely provoke China into conflict. To provoke war with China, the Taipei government would have to declare independence. Washington has been encouraging the ruling Democratic Progressive Party to inch toward that red line, selling the party leaders the idea that the U.S. is ready to go to war with Taiwan. However, a majority of people in Taiwan do not find American assurances credible, do not believe Taiwan can win a proxy war against China, and cannot justify the death and destruction it would entail just to make Washington happy. In the meantime, Beijing has invoked the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, and declared that the waters of the Taiwan Strait are within the territorial waters of China. Henceforth, any vessels belonging to foreign countries that sail between the mainland and Taiwan and challenge the sovereignty of China will be subject to attack without notice. China is a signatory of UNCLOS, while the U.S. is not. Beijing has drawn the red line based on international law. Continued provocation by American officials in Taiwan will put U.S. vessels in the Taiwan Strait in jeopardy. The Beijing expression of its intentions is as stark and unequivocal as it can be. The next move will be up to the Pentagon to see if it is willing to test China's resolve. There can be no question that China would rather fire on the U.S. Navy than threaten Taiwan with missiles. Heretofore, Biden has depended on creating more money out of thin air to keep the American economy going.
Printing money has been so easy that sending $40 billion to Ukraine seems pain-free. However, conflict over Taiwan and waters around there would surely lead to a meltdown of the Fed printing stress.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. And Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, it is interesting to know that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the testamentary trustee and he was the seventh divinely appointed successor, vice regent, Imam of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. It is interesting, but we find in the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam that he went through great ordeals, difficulties, trials, tribulations, troublesome afflictions, and it was not limited to these. Matter of fact, Imam al-Kazim was held hostage in prisons. He was put through pain and torture, and it can be said that he was very much like the Messiah, Isa ibn Maryam, in his devotions, his piety, and his asceticism. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن لقمان قال لابنه إن الدنيا بحر عميق قد غرق فيها عالم كثير فلتكن سفينتك فيها تقوى الله وحشوها الإيمان وشراعها التوكل وقيمها العقل ودليلها العلم وسكانها الصبر.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, Luqman said to his son, the world is a deep ocean in which many wells have already drowned. So make God-wariness your boat, faith its content, trust in Allah its sail, reason its custodian, knowledge its guide, and patience its inhabitants.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the beautiful dialogues of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. When talking about the conversations and dialogues of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find in one certain conversation where Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam was speaking with the people, and the people had asked Imam Al-Kadhim about trusts and the ownership and truthfulness, as well as treason and the different qualities that each one of them has. Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, in one sentence, really completed all of these questions that the people had. His Eminence said that making over trusts or giving back trusts to their owners and truthfulness wins provision, while treason and lying win poverty and hypocrisy. It is unfortunate that in today's day and age, we think that lying and treason and cheating and betrayal and deception, these things will bring about provision and they will bring about prosperity, whether it's usually it's prosperity and wealth. This is what the cutthroat culture is like in the world, when in reality, when you see what is happening beneath the surface, we will find that treason and lying, they only bring about poverty and hypocrisy, both in this world and the next. But on the other hand, giving over a trust, giving back a trust to its rightful owner, and along with that truthfulness, honesty, saying the truth, acting upon the truth, this is what truly brings about provision and prosperity, both in this world and the hereafter. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
The aspect of, or I should say, one of the aspects that made the imamah of Imam Al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, very critical is the conditions that ended up being the conditions of the ummah and the conditions of the movements of the Ahlul Bayt during that period. From my reading and my understanding of Imam Al-Kadhim, salamullah alayhi, which manifests in the prison imprisonment of the Imam, we're going to talk about that, inshallah. That's part of this tactic of the Imam. Imam Al-Kadhim's speech, where he mentioned what he mentioned, the wording he used was provocative. In other words, he used dangerous language against the system. He was open in not criticizing the system, not alluding to the injustice of the system, alluding to it needing to be removed and a different government, a government of justice being established. He didn't allude to those things. He was very specific. Sometimes he would say it clearly and openly in the presence of the Khalifa. I have not seen something like this from other imams in this way.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Taxing the excess profits of large corporations within the G7 alone could raise an estimated $430 billion to fight world hunger, deliver vaccine to entire world, and make a giant dent in the fight to drive down fossil fuel pollution and jumpstart the necessary renewable energy transition. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by John Quayle, journalist. This article is published under the heading global windfall profit tax of 90% needed to address catastrophic food and climate crises, Oxfam says. Stay tuned for more. With G7 leaders meeting in Germany for their annual summit, Oxfam International is demanding a global windfall profits tax on the massive financial gains made by large corporations over the last 2 years of COVID-19 pandemic, a tax that could fund major international initiatives to address the spiraling crises of hunger, poverty, and the climate emergency. With billions of people around the world struggling to afford food and millions facing acute hunger and famine-like conditions, the group said in a communique released recently that G7 leaders must drive straight into the unique and dire circumstances triggered by the pandemic, during which many major companies profited mightily to set out a properly funded plan that would tackle the food crisis and vaccine apartheid and provide people of developing nations the resources needed to fend off the worst impacts of a rapidly heating planet. New Oxfam research, the group says, shows that a 90% windfall tax on the excess profits made by G7's largest corporations during the pandemic could generate almost $430 billion. This money, the group argues, could fully fund the shortfalls on all existing humanitarian appeals and a 10-year plan to end hunger, while also raising enough for a one-off payment of over $3,000 to the poorest 10% of the population of the G7 countries to help cover the rising cost of living. According to Oxfam, the G7 need to double the amount of aid they provide for agriculture, food security, and nutrition, amounting to $15 billion per year. At the same time, they need to fully fund the $46 billion United Nations Global Humanitarian Appeal, which is only 21% funded today. Oxfam research shows that corporations in the energy, food, and pharmaceutical sectors, where monopolies are especially common, are posting record high profits, even as wages have barely budged and workers struggle with decades-high prices and COVID-19. The fortunes of food and energy billionaires have risen by $453 billion in the last 2 years, equivalent to $1 billion every 2 days. Five of the largest energy companies, including BP, Shell, Total Energies, Exxon, and Chevron, are together making the $2,600 profit every second. There are now 62 new food billionaires. The Ukraine-Russia crisis has had a huge impact on food prices, but these are fueled by long-standing inequalities and failures in the global food system. Equally, the COVID-19 pandemic and the climate crisis have deeply harmed the ability of poor people and poor nations to cope. Between April 2020 and December 2021, wheat prices had increased by 80%. In Munich recently, thousands marched to demand the G7 nations meet their obligations to the world. With fears growing of an already dire food crisis that experts warn will only intensify due to the ongoing crisis in Russia and Ukraine and climate-driven droughts that have pushed regions of Africa, the West Asia and South Asia into famine-like conditions, Oxfam warns that even the announcement from the G7 to forge a new global alliance for food security will not be enough. This global hunger crisis coming on top of the pandemic is catastrophic, said Gabriela Butcher, Oxfam International's executive director, recently. Butcher added, "The G7 have a chance to show ordinary people that they are on their side and not that of the corporates and creditors making huge excessive profits from these multiple crises. The G7 must implement a coordinated initiative of windfall taxes and debt cancellation to fully fund an action plan to end world hunger. Across all countries, as food and energy costs spiral," she said, "it is the poorest and most marginalized people who are faced with the most desperate choices. Because hunger, just like the climate crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic, thrives on inaction," Butcher said, "world leaders must be ambitious with concrete initiatives, including the institution of the windfall tax on corporate profits. We know that large corporations are making very significant profits and have been making them during the pandemic," Butcher told The Guardian, as she singled out the fossil fuel industry as well as food giants and pharmaceutical companies. "We have calculated how much excess profits there has been during the pandemic, and taxing excess profits as a windfall tax would generate resources both for the most affected populations in the richer countries," she said, adding, "and to be able to fulfill commitments in terms of aid and responding to the worst suffering in the world."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we would like to express our condolences to our esteemed listeners on the martyrdom of the ninth Imam of the family of the Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad, the son of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at an hadith which has been narrated from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, regarding Imam Jawad. This simultaneously is not only a testament to the purity of the character and even the physical appearance of the Imam, but it's also a testament to his imamat. And this is actually one of the very important discussions in Shiite theology, the proofs for the imamat of each of the imams. Because as you know, throughout the history of Shiism, we have had many divergences. A lot of sects have shot off from traditional Isna Ashariya Shiism because they believe that somebody other than the 12 imams that we believe in were the imams. So, you know, this gave rise to a lot of disputes. So this hadith is not only a testament to the purity and the loftiness of the character of the imam, it's also a proof for his imamat. This hadith goes as follows. The Prophet was asked by Abdullah ibn Mas'ud. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, as you know, is one of the companions of the Prophet, a very famous companion of the Prophet. He was asked regarding the imams from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam began recounting the names of the imams from the progeny of Imam Hussein alayhi salam until he reached Imam Jawad. And when he did so, he said the following: وَيَخْرُجُ مِنْ سُلْبِ عَلِيٍّ, and from the loins of Ali, meaning Imam Ridha alayhi salam, Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, his son Muhammad, which is a reference to Imam Jawad. And the Prophet extolled and praised Imam Jawad in the following way. He said, Al-Mahmud, the praised one, which is a reference to the fact that the Imam was praised and was loved by the people was beloved, or even beloved by God. And then the Prophet said, أَطْحَرُ النَّاسِ خَلْقًا, he is the purest of people in form, the most purest of people in form, وَأَحْسَنُهُمْ خُلْقًا, and the best of them in character, the best of them in character, both physically and spiritually, the best and most refined and purified of all human beings in his era, which is the reason why he was chosen to be the Imam. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at Imam Jawad alayhi salam in the words of his noble grandfather, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
This one lay.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo.